WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
There are at least seven potential candidates for the mayor's race.
I'm running for mayor of the city of Chicago.
I'm all in ensuring that we have another successful year.
We are just 2 months away from the next primary election in Illinois.
Illinois lawmakers are back in Springfield ahead of the spring legislative session.
The federal government and Congress has taken money away from the state of Illinois. The state has to come up with the money to fill that gap.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. The Trump administration's been hit with a new lawsuit from Chicago and Illinois officials. The 2026 primary elections are right around the corner. Plus, as the Chicago Bears gear up to face the LA Rams, top Illinois lawmakers are in talks with the team about a new stadium.
If you believe impeachment is silly, then you are not taking your job or our Constitution seriously.
President Trump is threatening to send federal troops to Minnesota.
Do not take the bait. Do not allow them to deploy federal troops into here.
In Illinois, the Attorney General is suing the Trump administration over its use of federal forces in the state.
They're not trained to do immigration enforcement in the interior.
We're going to start today's episode with immigration matters, but first, a quick look at the 2027 mayoral election, which is still a ways off, but folks like Congressman Mike Quigley have thrown their hat in the ring. Mayor Brandon Johnson, on the other hand, just went through a bruising budget battle and is working to rebuild his relationship with the city council. Now, one of our panelists is here to dig in with us, Mariah Wolfel, who's WBEZ's city government and politics reporter. Hey, Mariah.
Hey, Sasha.
Thank you for stopping by. Good to see you.
Of course. You too.
So, as I just described, not the rosiest picture there for Mayor Johnson, especially over the last several weeks. I wonder, as someone who covers City Hall, how strong you would say his position is in the 2027 mayoral race.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at his track record, he has made a lot of mistakes, right? And I think it's a question of how much people are paying attention to the nitty-gritty details of city politics. You know, if you look at the budget season, he had this power struggle with city council members, and he lost that battle.
Right.
But is the average person judging Mayor Brandon Johnson on, you know, how long it took to pass a budget, even though the budget was passed before the deadline?
Probably
with no
not.
Layoffs? Right. And so, you know, if the average person is looking at the city budget, they're looking at, okay, the fee for the plastic bag tax went up, you know, by 5 cents. There might be video gambling terminals in Chicago bars and restaurants, but there was no property tax hike. There were no major layoffs and no major programmatic cuts. And so, you know, when you're talking about how this budget plays a role into his chances, I think those are the factors. And you also have to ask the question of, like, how people view this budget season if they are paying close attention
to
it. Because there are some people who view this budget season and say, man, the mayor is really weak and he can't get done what he wants to get done, which is progressive revenue to fund programs in the city of Chicago. And so I think he's weak and therefore I'm not going to vote for him. Or there's probably a large set of people, and you have to ask the question, how large is the progressive, the far left progressive base that looks at this and says, this is a mayor who fought to the bitter end for progressive revenue in the city.
Yes.
And that, to me, is a positive. And I want to see him do that for the next 4 years. And maybe we'll get some small incremental wins along the way.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you look at, then you get start to get into who's going to be challenging the mayor.
Yes.
And what decisions people are making. Because if he gets into a runoff with someone who's maybe a bit more moderate or conservative, that can't flip any of the progressive base, you know, maybe Johnson's chances increase. And so it kind of, it depends who we see.
Who else is in there?
Who can get people excited? Yep. Who can energize the progressive base? And then there are all these other factors, like Johnson's positioning in light of all of the attacks by the federal government.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he really did rise to the national spotlight mm-hmm. when it comes to how he handled federal agents being in our city. But when you think about it, we're talking about 2027, Mariah.
Yeah.
I feel like it's too soon to tell.
That really is the too long didn't read answer. A lot can happen until then, and we're all looking to see how this shapes up.
Well, all right. This is just one of several stories that we got into today. So let's dive in. Thank you again, Mariah.
Thank you.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Jacoby Cochran, who's host of CityCast Chicago, a daily podcast and newsletter, and A.D. Quick, who's a Cook County and Chicago government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Now, President Trump is threatening to invoke the Insurrection Act on our Midwestern neighbor, Minnesota. That warning came just hours after another person was shot by an ICE agent in Minneapolis. This isn't the first time Trump has threatened to invoke this centuries-old law. So Jacoby kicked things off with his thoughts.
Seems like the Insurrection Act is Trump's personal boogeyman. He likes to incite it anytime he believes he can grow his authority in a place where he helped sow chaos, whether it was in Portland, whether it was in Chicago, and now in the Twin Cities. The Insurrection Act allows the president to intervene when legally necessary with military troops if there's any threat to federal land, federal property, or federal officers. And again, Trump's administration is hopeful that they and their lawyers can interpret this very broadly. Mm. Because I think for their administration, they believe that the Insurrection Act, which will allow them to put military troops in, say, Minnesota, is just one step towards more military control in these Democratic-led states. And so I don't think he entirely believes that it is justifiable, yeah. which is why he just continues to threaten it versus to really push it forward. But I do think we are getting closer because— You know, they're only going to continue to harass, kidnap,
right.
and shoot and kill people in these cities.
Yeah, he's threatening this, but this is already a very tense situation. So doesn't it feel like this could just be escalated even further?
Yeah, but I think a lot of judges have stepped in to say this does not meet the criteria of the Insurrection Act, which hasn't been utilized in quite some time. And they are also pointing out that much of the chaos, much of the violence on the ground is happening from federal officers. It's coming by way of Border Patrol, mm-hmm. by way of ICE. And despite them time and time again going in front of judges and lying and saying their cars are being rammed, that they're being harassed, that they fear for the safety of their life, many judges to this point have not found that to be substantiated by evidence.
Yeah. Earlier this week, Chicago and Illinois filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration's aggressive immigration crackdown that you just described, Jacoby. Minneapolis and Minnesota also filed a similar lawsuit. Can you give us details, Mariah?
Yeah, the one by Illinois and Chicago accuses the feds of organized bombardment where uniformed military-trained personnel who are carrying semi-automatic firearms and military-grade weapons, you know, have kind of rampaged the streets of Chicago for months. The lawsuit contains claims about the feds' use of biometric data, making warrantless arrests, immigration enforcement at sensitive locations like we've all seen and some of us
schools.
Have covered at schools yeah. and courthouses. This is all according to reporting by federal courts reporter John Seidel and politics reporter Tina Svondelis at the Sun-Times, who covered this week. They wrote that it's the broadest challenge yet to the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement campaign. And it really is an effort by Illinois to maintain its sovereignty from the federal government. And the judge who's going to oversee this case, it was decided this week, is actually the same judge who oversaw the case by protesters and journalism organizations over some of the same tactics mm-hmm. by the feds. And Judge Sarah Ellis actually, in that case, restricted the feds' use of tear gas in Chicago. State attorneys specifically asked for Ellis because they argued that she is familiar with
yes.
the facts of the case. And Ellis agreed and said, you know, because the court is up to speed on what happened in Chicago and kind of the issues that have arisen, mm-hmm. you know, it would make sense for her to take on the case, and so she'll be
right.
overseeing it.
Of course, I asked Mayor Johnson about this when he was on In the Loop on Tuesday for our monthly series, Ask the Mayor. Here's what he had to say about joining in on the suit.
As I've said repeatedly, this is about terrorizing and dividing communities. This lawsuit is another effort to provide some real check and balance to this administration. We've used many different tools, as you know, executive orders, legislation, and, of course, litigation.
And you can listen to that full interview on the In the Loop podcast. AD, I turn to you now because I wonder, how strong do you think that the legal arguments are from the two states?
I'm not a legal expert, but other legal experts have said this is the biggest swing that any of these jurisdictions have taken, and it will be a very, very steep uphill climb mm-hmm. to actually win this argument. So the attempt is to essentially block ICE from enforcement here. And short of that, by declaring that certain ICE tactics are unconstitutional. There is no precedent for it. Neither Illinois nor Minnesota cite any cases where a judge agreed to keep federal law enforcement from doing their job in a given state. We'll probably hear a lot about the Supremacy Clause. We're getting like deep into centuries-old American law. State and local authorities can't block feds from doing their job, essentially. And Article 2 gives the feds the power to enforce federal law. So this is my unprofessional legal opinion. This could morph in some way to address what the cities and states see as abuses or excesses of ICE. So violations of individual constitutional rights, unlawful searches, improper detentions, injury or death, as we've seen. People can sue for those. So this is different legally from the National Guard deployment mm-hmm. that we also talked about, the Supremacy Clause, a lot around. But I think this is also a symbolic effort from continued symbolic efforts from state and local officials to say, we do not want this. And yes. we want the public to be aware of how much we don't want this. And other like-minded Democrats should be pushing back as forcefully as they can, not only to tell their constituents what they care about, but to also like present themselves politically as against this.
Right.
Yeah. And Ellis was the one who brought, you know, Commander Greg Bovino into her courtroom. And so on that note, it's also about, you know, creating a legal document right. of the anecdotes and experiences mm-hmm. of Chicagoans, and then having the feds respond to that in court as well.
Yeah, I mean, right. to your point, there's no precedent for this, and it will be difficult to prove. Experts quoted on CNN say, you know, the arguments that both states are making, that ICE should be blocked either entirely or just the surge, are close to completely meritless.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this won't be easy. Now, relatedly, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, you know, she said she was going to do it. And she did it. She introduced articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. This was for her handling of the crackdown. The three articles, they accuse Noem of obstruction of Congress, violation of public trust, and self-dealing. What do you think about all that, Jacoby? Fair?
I do. I think Robin Kelly, who is currently running for the open U.S. Senate seat in Illinois, I do think she believes what she is saying, that those like Kristi Noem, Greg Bovino, they are the faces of this administration's unconstitutional and increasingly violent campaign, and thus they have to be held accountable. Mm-hmm. They have been caught up in courtrooms and in front of cameras, blatantly lying. Their rhetoric, I think, has only emboldened ICE officers and Border Patrol officers to pursue violence, to interact with community members with nothing but maliciousness. And so I don't know how far this will ultimately go. I don't think the federal government at large will follow through on this. But I do think it's important to, again, have this record of how many different attempts we've taken to challenge this administration.
Now, the day after those two lawsuits were filed, the president said he would stop federal payments to sanctuary cities like ours, like Chicago. He's threatened this before, Mariah. So once again, something we've seen already. I wonder how worried we should be this time.
Yeah, as you said, this is not a new issue for Chicago, and it's been in court before. A judge in August actually issued an injunction in a lawsuit over a similar threat from Trump, and that injunction is meant to stop the Trump administration from blocking funding for sanctuary cities. In Chicago, that funding was for community development block grants, and Trump has appealed that injunction. But, you know, in terms of being worried, I think, unfortunately, the thing is that you have to take these threats seriously because funding is on the line, and Chicago relies on a lot of federal funding, specifically for programs on the ground, grants for, I mean, the Chicago Department of Public Health is funded primarily through federal funding. And so that's a huge department that's important to the lives of many Chicagoans right there. You know, in response to this, Johnson said that Trump's announcement is blatantly unconstitutional and immoral. Pritzker said, quote, we've beaten the administration in court before and we're not afraid to keep doing so. And so definitely something to watch as it plays out and what their next steps will be.
And Adi, we got a little more insight, if you will, into how Chicagoans feel about all of this. All this immigration enforcement activity in our area. There was a new survey out from the University of Chicago. What did it say exactly?
So this poll happened immediately after the feds left from Midway Blitz, which feels like a very long time ago. This was between—
You mean before they came back again?
Before they came back again. Round one, Midway Blitz.
Gotcha.
So the poll was out in the field between November 24th and December 8th. This was after Judge Ellis's decision came out. Everyone, like all of the facts of the case were well established. So it was aimed at just Chicagoans over 18. Quite a few interesting results. I wish I had like a whiteboard or like a Steve Kornacki like sliding thing so you guys aren't just hearing numbers. But the overall numbers were, the top line numbers were not surprising. So Chicago is a blue city. Stands to reason our opposition to an action like this from a Republican administration would be a little higher than the numbers nationwide. So the full phrasing of the question I was following most closely is, when it comes to deporting individuals who are in the country without legal documentation, would you say recent federal immigration enforcement activities have? And then you had your options. So 65% said they had gone too far. Mm-hmm. About 20% said it was about right or hadn't gone far enough. And a little under 14% said they weren't sure. So nationwide, that gone too far number was 53% in October in a Pew poll and in 52% in a CNN poll from this month after the shooting of Renee Good in Minnesota. That is up from 45% last February. So that was kind of unsurprising, the Chicago numbers. When you dig into certain demographics, it gets a little more surprising, and I'm interested what you guys think about if this was your impression of how the public felt.
Yeah.
So the gone too far figure was almost 75% on the north side, not the northwest. So like north side, Lincoln Park up to Rogers Park, basically. Okay. 53% on the south side, 57% on the west side. That's the gone too far figure. For respondents over 75, gone too far figure was 76%. The lowest was 58% among those 55 to 64. 27% of respondents in my age group, 35 to 44, so mostly millennials, had said it's been about right or has not gone far enough. That was the highest of any age group. Support for the city's welcoming ordinance, also highest among white people, 75 strongly or somewhat supported it. Lowest for black people at 44.7%. Black respondents also had the highest, I'd say, ambivalence. So 40% said they neither supported nor opposed or weren't sure about the sanctuary policy.
Yeah, that part is unsurprising. What comes to mind for you, Jacoby, hearing just some of those numbers?
We live in a segregated city.
We do.
And I believe, especially listening to my family during the holiday season, you get a mix, right? There are some people who all they see is the propaganda from the federal government, yeah, which I think we have to always address across this country's history, is well-funded,
yeah,
is strategic, is targeted. I also think there is this concern in Chicago about sort of resource scarcity. You know, what's my community has been divested
right
from, is there a, you know, sort of welcome a welcoming city comparison for black Chicagoans, for example? And so I know a ton of people feel this sense of hierarchy in our city, like whose needs are being met.
Yeah, I ran into a lot of folks who were kind of just heads down about it, just like, this is not particularly my fight, so I'm just going to keep moving in this direction.
Yeah, I also have seen a ton of folks who have organized for the last decade plus and are tired, who also feel like, we told you this was going to happen. We warned you. And now our emotional and physical attention, I don't have it to give it fully
right
to this current crisis because we fully predicted this turn towards full scale authoritarianism. But with that being said, I still believe there is more work to be done to continue to inform parts of this city of what's going on,
sure,
maybe outside of their neighborhood. And I do believe when you really get into conversations with people and go past the polls, there is a lot more empathy. And most of the frustration is geared towards officials who they don't believe
right
are adequately and effectively addressing needs across the city. And so I understand some of the frustration in this moment.
Real quick, let's squeeze in one more immigration story, AD. You've got an update on a political candidate who was arrested for protesting outside of Broadview.
Right. So this is Kat Sharp. She was a candidate for Cook County Board on the north side, Bridget Degnan's seat. Bridget Degnan is leaving the county board. Kat Sharp was one of several candidates for that position. She is one of the Broadview Six. This is a group of folks who were in one of several protests outside the ICE detention facility in Broadview, who federal prosecutors say were part of a conspiracy to impede an immigration agent, damaging an ICE SUV, including scratching the car's body, breaking a side mirror and windshield wiper, and etching the word pig into the paint. The Broadview Six are very optimistic about how the case will go for them. They think it's kind of overblown. But last week, Kat Sharp announced she was dropping out of that county board race because fighting it has been so emotionally taxing, and it will also be expensive. She currently works in Alderman Andre Vasquez's office. She said she's still confident she'll win and that the charges are ridiculous, but she's like, I do not have the capacity to both run for public office and mount this defense and raise money for both things.
Right.
I asked her if she thought this was essentially a win for the Trump administration, because she said in her statement, the goal of the Trump administration is to force opponents to sit down and shut up. And she said the whole thing has refocused her attention on winning this case for one, but also helping out her neighbors.
Yeah. And before we take a pause, Mariah, just shifting over to City Hall here. I mean, it was a historic move. We saw a rival city budget passed before the end of 2025. But Mayor Johnson and Alderman, they're still kind of fine-tuning that budget, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, he spoke maybe most recently about this on your show this week, saying that he still believes that these revenue projections might be faulty and still warning of potential mid-year layoffs. Doesn't know how that will look, doesn't know if that's programmatic cuts or, you know, layoffs to job positions. One of the revenue streams that's really up in the air that the Tribune reported on this week is video gambling.
Right.
You know, that's a big feat to kind of implement in the city of Chicago, and Johnson still hasn't taken the first step to do that by notifying the state of the city's intentions to do so. And his senior advisor told the Tribune this week that, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done with Alders. And I think there's interest in this one because this is one that makes a big difference in people's lives. If you're going to a bar or restaurant in Chicago, are there video gambling terminals? Does that, you know, pose problems for communities that struggle with addiction to gambling? Or does it make your life better in some way if you enjoy those types of things? So watching that and many other, revenue streams that may or may not come in.
There's so many smallish revenue streams that were included in this budget that we are all going to be watching closely this first quarter of how the returns go to see if end of Q1, we kind of got to go back to the drawing board a bit.
One I did notice this week is the 15-cent plastic bag fee. You'll notice that. That's
felt that
new
one
in the budget.
Yep.
That's why I hit zero every time. How many bags did you use at this
stuff? Zero.
You're holding 10. You're like zero.
I am sure.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I realize many of us are laser focused on the Bears these days, but voting for the March primary election actually begins next month. Mail-in ballots go out February 5th. That's also when early voting begins. Jacoby, what are some of the races that you're watching?
Well, we got a lot of retirements this year. I feel like I've talked about it ad nauseum over the last 6 months.
So-and-so is giving up their seat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, these 50 people are jumping in.
Exactly. Our 90s babies are all leaving, 90s political babies in their current seats.
I was going to say.
Right. I was like, excuse me?
Some 30s, 40s babies.
Excuse me? We're getting those 90s babies in now.
All the millennials are leaving.
The politically
Boomers
90s
out,
babies.
Millennials
so,
in.
Dick Durbin, who's been in the Senate since the late 90s, Danny Davis, my congressperson, in the 70s. 7th, Jan Schakowsky up in the 9th. And then you have a few who are leaving, like Tree Garcia in the 4th to retire.
Oh, yeah.
The 2nd district is open as Robin Kelly goes for the Senate seat. The 8th district is open as Roger Krishnamoorthy goes. We'll have a new lieutenant governor. Tony Preckwinkle has a challenger for Cook County Board of Prayers. I don't think they got a chance, but you know what I'm saying. And so most of what I have been trying to grapple my wrap my head around is the fact that in some form or another, you're just going to have new people in these positions. And so it isn't as simple as like, oh, I can just kind of lean into my incumbent and then maybe look at like two or three challenges, or my incumbent is running unchallenged.
Now you got to do your research.
I got to process the 15, 17. And we actually posted a video on CityCast Chicago recently where we talked about some of the front runners in some of these cases. And, you know, people got in our comments and was like, hey, don't disenfranchise some of the other candidates. And I hear you. It is hard to talk 10 plus people, especially in the supermajority that we live in. And the primary is likely our, you know, to stay with football, our Super Bowl for a lot of these elections. They'll be decided in March. And so it's tough when you got to make your way between 8 to 17 candidates, but we got to do it.
We got to do it. And listen, folks, do you have questions for Illinois political candidates this primary election season? WBEZ wants to hear from you. Take our brief survey. It's up online right now. Go to WBEZ.org/survey. AD, you looked into the tax returns of some of these candidates.
It was a thrill.
The ones running for positions in Cook County. Just give us the highlights.
Highlights.
How bad is it?
Bad?
Good?
I mean, they're making money.
In the middle? Okay.
They're making money. So I looked at the countywide candidates, so candidates for assessor and board president, the Democrats. Like Jacoby said, March is kind of the Super Bowl here. This is what we're watching for closely. So Fritz Kagi, who's running for another term as county assessor, the person who is in charge of deciding how much your property is worth and ultimately what becomes your property tax bill. He is an investor. I have known for a long time that he is a very wealthy person because he has been self-funding his campaigns over the years with millions of dollars, but I never knew exactly how much he was making. So found out on his tax returns, he was getting a lot from investments, essentially. Some years, more than $1 million in investments and stock dividends, essentially. His challenger is Pat Hines. He is on the other end of the spectrum, a volunteer firefighter and a township assessor. Those are suburban folks who help people with appeals and understand their assessments. Also in the family business of rentals.
Okay.
So owns several properties. And I think this is part of what makes him so interested in what commercial assessments look like, commercial and residential assessments, and whether they're right or wrong. Tony Preckwinkle, as we discussed, running for re-election as board president, longtime politician. She's in her late 70s. So of course she's been able to collect both her city pension from being an alderman of the fourth ward and also Social Security.
Okay.
Her challenger, Brendan Riley, alderman of the 42nd Ward, also running. I knew that he has some political consultancies going, but he hadn't been doing that for the last few years. His tax returns, he gave me the smallest batch of actual papers to look at, but it did show that he was making some side money doing essentially political consulting and that his wife also does media buying.
Interesting.
Yeah.
This is further down the road, Mariah, but you know, some people are already starting to talk about the 2027 mayoral election. Do we know yet? I mean, what names do we know so far about, you know, as possible candidates going against Brandon Johnson?
Well, first, tell me who's talking about it, because I have a bone to pick with him. Because we have an election to cover first. No, I'm just kidding.
Like, why are we there? We're not there yet.
So well, there's some people who are like, I'm not really in, but I'm about to be.
And I'll officially announce later, but wink, wink.
Those are the people who didn't want to run, but the community just, there's a groundswell and the community
the people
forced
need
them
people
to do it.
People are stopping me in the streets, shaking me by the shoulders and saying, please run for mayor.
But one person who's already thrown his hat into the ring officially is you, well, you know, as officially as you can at this stage, which is telling a reporter.
By talking to all media.
U.S. Representative Mike Quigley of Illinois. He's been
no relation to me.
Yes. Oh.
No, you shortened your name. You didn't want the nepo connections.
You're just Quig. Right. Yeah.
He's been in office since 2009. He was a Cook County commissioner before that and plans to stay in the race. He says, even if another top name, Illinois Secretary of State Alexi Janulius, runs, he's got millions in his campaign pot to throw his name in the race. We could also be looking at retiring state comptroller Susana Mendoza, who's run before, mm-hmm. Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas, who's flirted with running maybe every single mayoral election.
Yeah.
Especially, definitely that I've been covering politics.
You're like, my entire career, she's been saying this.
34th Ward Alderman Bill Conway. I think it's a long shot for an alderman to
but listen,
win mayor.
Get back to Quigley for just a second. Isn't he a Packers fan?
Yes.
Does that disqualify someone for running from Chicago
Well,
mayor?
You know, he hasn't filed his paperwork yet, so we got to see what the state board of elections.
He going to switch his fan.
He does have a campaign committee for
city elections.
Yeah, and the caps are already off.
Well, let me ask the authority here at the table, Jacoby. Can a Packers fan be mayor of Chicago?
The answer is obviously no, but I was the hesitation was because I was trying to say, can I say something meaner?
Like, not at 9 a.m.
He could
here
be
on
the
WBEZ.
Bears' biggest fan, and I don't think he has a chance. But you know, I do think that's going to be tough to square pulling up at like.
I
you
don't.
Know,
yeah, I don't think you can be a Packers fan and be mayor. He is trying to use that
weird.
To his advantage, though, saying that like.
This
he's
makes
being
me more opposed than ever for the Bears getting any money for a stadium. Yeah.
That song is starting to change a little bit, and mm-hmm. so he might be on the out by the time he's running.
All right, let me keep you in the hot seat for a second here, Jacoby. Illinois lawmakers are back in Springfield, so tell me the top issues that they're likely going to be grappling with in the spring legislative session. Mm-hmm.
Illinois Senate was together this week. Illinois House next week. They'll come together in February when Governor Pritzker delivers his State of the State address. Some big things on their radar, $2.2 billion budget gap, increasing funding constraints from the federal government. According to reports, they received $83 million less from the federal government in December than they did a year ago. Affordability seems to be the word of the day on every single person's calendar every single person's word of the day calendar.
Yeah.
Because, of course, we're all being hit from healthcare, insurance, the grocery store, rents, property. People need relief. And at the same time, the most vulnerable in our communities who rely on SNAP benefits, who rely on Medicaid, the state is also looking at, you know, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars being cut over the next few years to those programs. And, you know, I also think that they're probably thinking about that pesky little election we were just talking about that's going to wrap up March 17th. And so I don't imagine any major big swings taken, but the conversation around how can we make things more affordable?
Yeah.
How will we continue to Trump-proof Illinois at large will be at top of mind. But I don't think with an election they're going to be really talking about reevaluating our public safety budgets, really hitting the wealthiest people across our state to increase taxes so that we can pay for some of these social service programs. And so I'm really interested to see how they walk what will likely be a very tepid line, mm-hmm. no big swings, but people are hurting and you're asking to be their representatives for the next few years. And so I'm interested to hear people's tone.
You mentioned health in there. I mean, the state's new health insurance marketplace, we should note, Get Covered Illinois. It announced that it's extending the enrollment deadline to the end of the month for folks to be able to jump in and enroll into a health insurance plan. Yesterday, I talked with Morgan Winters, who's director of Get Covered Illinois. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
While costs are going up for some plans, they're actually going down for others. And so this can be a really complex calculus for customers.
So a lot of changes coming to healthcare this year because of the elimination of those federal subsidies at the end of 2025 AD. How might it impact hospitals?
So
inpatient.
I follow this pretty closely because I follow county government. The county runs its own hospitals and clinics, Cook County Health. Cook County runs a safety net system of clinics and hospitals that benefited a lot when more people got health care coverage. So more people were insured, more people would get preventative care that costs less. Fewer people showed up for charity care at emergency departments. That could backslide under this. So this is true for other hospitals and clinics as well. Fewer folks are insured. You'll have patients coming in for emergency care. This is often more expensive, less predictable. And when things get to the point where your health is very bad, mm-hmm. you're being treated for something generally at its worst. So the county is projecting between the tax credits being scaled back, not completely eliminated, and new rules around Medicaid. That's going to be the other big change this year. They are expecting that charity care to go up to $380 million this year. And that means taxpayers are helping pick that up, essentially. So that is up from the low in 2022 when it was $134 million. So I'm watching this closely for the financial impact it's going to have on the county.
Sure.
The House did approve a renewal of the credits, but the Senate has been opposed. The House vote included 17 Republicans and would have extended those credits. So the expanded credits. So people still qualify, but it was a lot. The qualifications were a lot broader during COVID. So straight up Senate passage of reaffirming that like 400% federal poverty line qualification is very slim. Republicans are looking for more strict income limits and for enrollees to at least pay something. But the clock is ticking. We're getting further into the year and it gets harder to like
absolutely
shove all that toothpaste back in the tube and get people covered.
Yeah, and I just want to note that because of the changing cost of health insurance premiums, we did see a drop in the number of people who enrolled in healthcare in Illinois. As of last week, it was just a 4% decrease in enrollment, which is far less severe than what we were anticipating, you know, toward the end of December there and what many experts were anticipating. Mm-hmm. But it will be interesting to see what happens, you know, as time moves on, because a lot of those people, nearly half of them, were folks who were automatically enrolled.
If they're like me with my Comcast bill, you don't notice until 3 months
in. You don't know. You're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Did this go up?
Yeah.
Yeah. AD, let's turn now to something impacting CPS. You recently looked into how late property tax bills impact our school districts. What'd you find out?
So I've been following the saga of Tyler Technologies at Cook County for a long time. Tyler Technologies is a contractor who's been upgrading the software that various county property tax offices use to get bills out the door. Bills were so late this year that a lot of school districts either had to borrow money to kind of make do to keep their cash flow going, cash out investments, or forego what they would have been getting in investments if that money had come in on time and it was just parked in the bank. Mm-hmm. So there's a group of suburban school district leaders from the north suburbs who rely really heavily on property tax revenue because they're not getting state aid. And they basically went around to every other district in Cook County and said, hey, how much money have you lost out on because of these delays? And the total sum, city and suburban, was $122 million.
Mm-hmm.
About half of that was CPS, either taking out tax anticipation warrants or notes, which is like borrowing just to kind of cover your spread for a few months. And these leaders want some kind of acknowledgement of how costly this has been through no fault of their own. But there's very, I asked County Board President Toni Preckwinkle about this yesterday. She was like, I sympathize, but there's not much that we can do. I will be interested to see if these groups, if these school districts get together and try to get money somewhere, including out of Tyler Technologies, who's been sued across the country for various data delays and missteps.
Well, Mariah, let's turn to another taxing issue, the tax on downtown hotels. That could soon be the highest in the country, and it would involve creating what's called a, quote, tourism improvement district. How would that work?
Yeah, so this would apply to hotels with 100 or more rooms in this designated area that would be in the, you know, business district downtown. And it would be called the Tourism Improvement District. And
the TID.
The TID.
Really? Are people calling it the TID?
Not I am. A TIF,
oh
but
my
a
gosh.
TID.
If I hear anyone say the TID, I'm going to shake my fist. Anyway, continue.
So within the TID, hotels would have to opt in.
Shaking my
fist. It's happening already.
So this was authorized at the state level, but the city has yet to take advantage of this. And the council's finance committee this week took the first formal step towards implementing this new tax by scheduling a public hearing on the topic. Alderman Jason Irvin, Mayor Brandon Johnson's budget leader, kind of led the effort to kind of get the ball rolling on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this revenue would go towards marketing the city's tourism. I mean, boosting city's tourism.
I'm guessing that these downtown hotels aren't supporting this proposed tax increase.
They
well,
are.
Actually, you'll be surprised. Because
I like it when I'm wrong.
Yeah. So Michael Jacobson, the president of the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association, actually told the Finance Committee that there's strong support from a majority of hotels within this district because this is a closed-loop fund. So it's fund that comes from hotels and has to go towards supporting hotels. That could be like it can pay for the bid application for, you know, something like the Democratic National Convention, mm-hmm. that brings a lot of visitors who need to stay in hotels. So it ultimately benefits hotels, and so they are supporting
it. Yeah, that extra $40 million in revenue could, you know, it goes directly to the Chicago Tourism Office, and you know, the 1.5 percentage point increase you know, would more than double Choose Chicago's marketing budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wonder if we should be concerned that having the highest downtown hotel tax in the nation might discourage folks from actually wanting to come here, like tourism and conventions. Are those things still going to happen, AD? What do you think?
I would imagine so. I mean, like, so much of why...
I don't even want to do a staycation with those numbers.
So much of why conventioneers choose Chicago. What a great name.
Yes.
Is like, what else we have going on? So people like coming to Chicago because we have beautiful museums and restaurants and culture and all these other things. And like, they can market better with this money. But yeah.
And it's so small too. I mean, it's within the downtown district.
Right.
It's within a district within that district and applies not to boutique hotels, but to larger, you know, Hilton, Sheraton, like rooms, hotels with 100 or more.
What's the district within that district called, Mariah?
So that would be the TID. I already forget what that stands for.
That
because
was me
it's just the TID
setting
in my
you
mind.
Up right there. we mentioned Choose Chicago. I mean, it says its operating budget of $33 million is the lowest of any major convention city. But you know what isn't the lowest?
Mm-hmm.
The salary for Choose Chicago's CEO. Yeah, get this. It has historically been well above $500,000. If you compare that to the mayor, who makes $221,000, and the Illinois governor, who makes just under $240,000. I don't know. Well, is that wild that the head of the tourism agency is making more than twice that of the mayor and governor?
Yes, I think two things can be true at one. One, that's a lot of money, over $500,000 to run Choose Chicago. More than the mayor, more than the governor, more than the heads of CTA and a few other crucial departments in our city. However, let's be real. We don't have a shortage of people trying to run for mayor. Or governor. So clearly the salary is not cost prohibitive.
Is enough.
Right. No. And the search for the Choose CEO took
a
very
over
long time.
A year. Yeah. And, you know, while Kristen Reynolds is not originally from Chicago, I've gotten to sit down and talk to her. I imagine you have as well. Right. She has a huge background in tourism. You know, I don't love to pocket watch, but I am a little confused on how it got bloated to this point.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine for Chicagoans who are on the hook for that, they are shocked hearing that number.
Right.
Just
sounds like it's a little jarring, but
but
when you break it down
knocks
like
you
that,
off, but you know, if the reason it is here is because it is very difficult to hire for this position and it's found itself getting pushed up by the people who've been in that office, then I know that there are some people over at CTA and in the mayor's office who are hearing this and going, well, maybe we should be asking for
a raise. And the justification for this is always, this is a person who is driving outside dollars into mm-hmm. Chicago and saving local taxpayers money, essentially, or like shifting a little bit of the burden. So I could see that argument.
And tourism is important.
Bit.
We cannot sustain our hotels, our restaurants, our entertainment industry without them, despite
without
how Chicagoans may feel about it. But
we
need those conventioners to pay off the debt on Soldier Field, McCormick Place.
While we're talking about tourism, I mean, do you think we're going to get many LA visitors for Sunday's game against the Rams?
Now they're Bears chickens. They can't stand this cold.
I will say, when we started the podcast, it was like 5 years ago, and we started it on March 17, 2021, with St. Patrick's Day. We went out, you know, it was still the height of the pandemic. Vaccines hadn't even come out. And there were a lot of Californians out here for St. Patrick's Day. I just say that part. But I agree with them. No, I don't think they're going to travel
March
17th
is freezing cold.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to travel well for this game.
They don't. Well, speaking of the Bears, I mean, have you noticed, Jacoby, that state political leaders maybe sound a little bit more optimistic about finding a way to work with the team on a new stadium?
Gee, we knew this was happening. I remember sitting down with my mom at the beginning of the year, and she's like, oh, do you think they're going to be good? And I said, I have no idea. No one knows. But the thing I'm most concerned about is if they get good, mm-hmm. this whole, we're not paying for billionaire stadium, which they still are holding strong to, but there's no appetite in Illinois for billions for a stadium. That has shifted to there is no appetite for billions for the physical stadium.
So the winning season has an impact, you think?
I think it goes, if they are losing right now, I think the way politicians continue to sort of laugh in their face, mm-hmm. kind of scoff, and kind of talk to them as if they're a joke. But now they do have to put a little bit of respect on the name because they also are trying to use that political capital. They're running for elections for seats right now, and they're going, bear down, bear down. Look at how good the Bears are. Oh, my God, the comeback kids. I'm going to be the comeback kid in this race. Right? They want to benefit from the cultural salience of a good Bears team. And so they have to say things like, come on, businesses in Illinois always get help with infrastructure. We were always willing to do that. Mm. I don't know. We read the transcript. Y'all seem pretty gung-ho. And then they start talking about Indiana, and people were like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah. So, well, you know, the team AD, it leaked photos of National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell touring Arlington Heights, as well as, you know, some other possible sites in Indiana. You give the Bears credit for playing the two states against each other?
Sure.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Smart move.
Well, it's one thing to just have dueling suburban and city sites where, like, uh-huh. there's some Arlington Heights person who's like, no, why would they build a new one here? Or why would they build a new one on the south side? I think Indiana is going about it the smartest way they can for for leverage's sake. They're kind of giving them everything they mm-hmm. want.
It's like Kansas-Missouri situation with the Chiefs.
Completely debt-free, essentially, situation. I just don't know how attractive this will ultimately be to the Bears in terms of maintaining that fan base that actually attends games. The reason they said Arlington Heights was the best one was because they had a concentration of fans who could get there.
Mm. Those Northwest Side dollars obviously mean a lot to them.
Yeah, and as a Hoosier myself, who travels through Northwest Indiana a lot, the infrastructure need to make this work, I think, would be great. And also, like, great as in challenging. And then Indiana having two NFL teams would also just be, like, mm-hmm. wild to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You think the threats to move to Indiana are real, Jacoby, or is this just a bargaining chip?
I think they're mostly a bargaining chip. I will be honest. When they first announced it, I was the person who came out and was like, well, you know, that's closer to my mama house than Arlington Heights. So,
Northwest Indiana's never been that bad.
I would pull up. My homie lives like 20 minutes from the proposed site in the south suburbs. And he was like, I would never cross the state lines to go to this game.
Oh, really?
I would never do that. I'd much rather go to Arlington Heights. And so it has clearly ruffled some feathers. I do think ultimately we're all sort of being played against one another. And I was at the Bears game against the Packers last week. And
you were?
I was.
Oh, how was
damn
that?
Damn good game. I got all of the best footage you could possibly get.
Oh, wow. Gosh, I
every
saw
touchdown
your Instagram.
In the fourth
I need
down,
to go to your Instagram.
It was incredible.
It was a fantastic experience. But I will say, me and my homie, we're leaving the game. We're walking back, and we're leaving. And I say, hey, this is why we're having this conversation, because we're leaving the game. There's nowhere for us to celebrate together.
Right.
There's no mm-hmm. way for us to come together and immediately go to a close restaurant. There's no way for us to just stand around the stadium and look at the jumbotron of highlight. There's nothing
there. Literally nothing there.
You got to trek to Miller's Pub.
And I didn't have to walk that far. I only live like a 15, 20-minute walk away. But the entire time I was walking back, I was like, there's nowhere for this place to sustain
and
thousands of people.
And it was so cold.
And it was so cold. There were no heaters. There was no Uber pickup station. The infrastructure for pre and post game just doesn't exist. And so I would love for them to stay there and invest in that.
Right.
But again, I've been to stadiums around the country, basketball, football, baseball, and the way people have invested in these entertainment districts,
mm-hmm.
You know, economically sucks for the taxpayer. But the game day experience, notwithstanding, it's vastly improved.
Well, I got to bring you into the conversation here, Mariah, because you deserve a shout out. You had your own Bears victory. You won the Chicago Public Media Staff Bears Bake Off.
You guys got to look at the pictures. The pictures are so good.
You have to see the photos. I mean, for those folks listening, real quick, you know, if they're planning, you know, to serve something for a game watching party this weekend, you got to give us your winning secret.
It's so funny
what flavor were the cookies?
So they were sugar cookies that were a little too hard. So they were more like just like a biscuit cookie.
Yeah, dunkable.
And then the frosting of the football, I tinted the frosting with cocoa powder. So they were pretty basic, but they were good. I love that I've been deemed the person to talk about, you know, desserts or football game day food, because I am not a baker. I just like to win. And so it was more about the presentation.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
I'm super proud of you.
I don't know that I have tips other than like make good food. I love a fruit plate during a football game.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, Jacoby, one real quick sports issue that I got to throw in. It has to do with college basketball and involves former DePaul players. What should we know?
So as of right now, a case coming out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania has named about 26 people as defendants accused of essentially rigging games in NCAA basketball as recent as last year, and I think as far back as like 2022, 2023. We've seen increasing cases of people being charged with fixing games in the NBA, and I think it was only a matter of time until that made its way into the NCAA. I think this system of not only legalizing gambling, but promoting online gambling, the ease, the way in which it has made its way into our pre and post game discussion in all professional sports. It's on ESPN every day. It's it's a ticker for spreads, how casual it's become in grammar schools and high schools. It was only a matter of time. And we're going to see more cases like this.
And so
you know, each individual, if they participated, you know, will likely be held accountable. But we need to be having a larger systemic conversation about what gambling is doing right now.
Oh, boy. All right. That is it for our weekly news recap. My thanks to Jacoby Cochran, A.B. Quigg, and Mariah Wolfel. Enjoy your weekend.
You too.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.